This is The Lack with Nina Power and Benjamin Studebaker. Today we're doing Yojimbo, and I will kick us off. Yojimbo came out in 1961. It was directed by Akira Kurosawa. It follows a ronin, a wandering samurai with no ties to any particular place. Yet this samurai finds himself in a troubled town. A gang war has broken out, and the local authorities are in league with the gangs. Young men are abandoning rural life to join these gangs, preferring lives of luxury to lives of toil. Our ronin chooses to get involved in all this. We might think he does it for money, but it becomes clear very quickly that money is not what motivates this guy. No, his goal is to free the town from gang violence by killing all the members of both gangs. He has very little help from the townspeople. Some of them have allied with the gangs to make a living. The rest try to stay out of the way. In Kurosawa's more famous Seven Samurai, the samurai train the peasants to defend themselves. But in Yojimbo, the townspeople have been too thoroughly debased by the gangs. They cannot organize themselves, and they cannot be organized by our ronin. There are no associations for the ronin to lead or join. It becomes clear that the ronin holds many of the townspeople in contempt. He says they're weak and stupid. But even though he has no regard for these people, and isn't tied to them in any way, he nonetheless decides to free them from the gangs. It seems he objects to the gangs in principle. As debased as the town people have become, they still don't deserve to be dominated by gangs. At one point, our ronin learns that one of the townspeople acquired so much gambling debt that he was forced to surrender both his house and his spouse to one of the gangs. The ronin thinks the gambler is a despicable man, but the gambler and his wife have a young son, and the son misses his mother. So the ronin emancipates the wife and reunites her with her shoddy husband. He urges them to leave before they are caught, but they start prostrating themselves before him in gratitude. He repeatedly denounces their idiocy. But when his role is discovered by one of the gangs, and they demand he give up the family's location, the ronin refuses. He protects these people even though he doesn't respect them, at great personal risk. The ronin is good with a sword, but he's no superhero. Without a blade, he's weaker than many men, and even with his blade, he knows he cannot block bullets. There are many scenes in which the ronin observes what's going on in the town and tries to come up with a clever way to intervene effectively without putting himself at too much risk. He observes that while the gangs are hostile to each other, they are also scared of one another. They posture a lot, but they only kill each other occasionally. Because the gangs never finish each other off, the gang war never ends. The town is held in terror not because there's too much violence, but because there's not enough. The way to end the killing is to accelerate it. So our ronin takes something of an accelerationist position. He begins looking for ways to escalate the conflict. He offers to work for one side or the other, and then he seizes opportunities to frame one side or the other for some slight. For instance, at one stage he kidnaps two members of the first gang, delivers them to the second gang, and then runs to the first gang to tell them the second gang has kidnapped their members. So the first gang retaliates by kidnapping the son of the leader of the second gang. This leads to a tense exchange of hostages. The exchange turns violent. There are many other similar frame-ups. The ronin sabotages their businesses, he disappears people. The gangs are already inclined to suspect one another, so it doesn't take much convincing to push them into confrontations. The gang members only pretend they want to fight, but if they are put in enough emotionally taxing situations, their posturing can easily be turned to bloodshed. At one point, the ronin leads one of the gangs against the other, only to resign shortly before the fight starts, on the grounds that he suspects the gang he's working for plans to murder him to avoid having to pay him. This has the benefit of being true. The ronin really did overhear the gang leader and his wife discussing such a plot. But without the ronin's help, the gang is now exposed. They've marched out to fight their rivals. They can't back down without looking weak. The ronin climbs to a tower so he can watch the fight. As the gangs posture and wave their blades at one another, he laughs at them from a position far above them. Gradually, over time, the ronin whittles down the two gangs. They get smaller and smaller. Eventually, one of the gangs defeats the other, but by this point, the winning gang is small enough that the ronin can defeat what's left of it on his own. Once both gangs are completely exterminated, he takes his leave. On his way out of town, he tells the constable who collaborated with the gangs to go hang himself. A couple weeks back, we watched The Land, a film in which divisions prevent villagers from organizing to overcome the authorities. In Yojimbo, it's the authorities that are divided. The villagers aren't able to exploit these divisions, but our Ronin can see what they cannot. He's able to find places to perch in the town. From these places, he observes the town's dynamics. Once he grasps them, he's able to make interventions that weaken the elites. The villagers do not understand these interventions, but they grasp that the Ronin is trying to help them, and so they grant him access to the perches. They feed him and offer him shelter. Because they take care of him, he doesn't have to worry about money. Whenever he does get any money, he gives it away, often to villagers in need. I wonder if something like this might be necessary now. Civil associations are in ruins, and both the workers and the elites increasingly fail to grasp their own situations. Both society and the state are now heavily divided. The workers aren't conscious of themselves as workers, and the oligarchs are drinking too much of their own Kool-Aid. We're not supposed to think about this sort of the thing on the left. This is, as Marx puts it, feudal socialism, a species of reactionary socialism in which a declining aristocracy attempts to ally with the working class as a means of resisting the bourgeoisie. The film is set in 1860. The samurai class is fading, but this Ronin attempts to realize the values of his class by seeking common cause with a peasantry he both fetishizes and disdains. Surely what's needed in 19th century Japan is not an alliance of samurai and peasants, but the imposition of the rule of law. Bourgeois rights enforced by a modern nation state so that Japan can go through capitalist development. That, of course, is what ended up happening in Japan. But I'm not talking about the 19th century or even about Japan. I'm talking about the 21st. As Adorno and Althusser pointed out in the middle of the 20th century, the state and the market have become involved in cultural production to the point where civil society organizations are no longer meaningfully independent. The working class increasingly does not have its own organizations, and the organizations that ostensibly belong to it are internally divided or penetrated from above. It was for this reason that the left in the 60s became so increasingly derelict. It increasingly lacked institutions through which it could propagate itself. It retreated into the universities, where it became increasingly estranged from the workers who once comprised it. The culture industry confused the workers and reduced their capacities, but it did not stop there. As culture marketized over the second half of the 20th century, our elites have become less conscious of the interests of their states. They increasingly do not support themselves as individuals, they increasingly do not subordinate themselves as individuals to abstract unities. As they become ever more focused on competing and struggling with one another for wealth and power, they create the conditions for conflict, both between and within states. Trade wars, climate change, constitutional showdowns, and refugee crises rear their heads. There are groupist fundamentalists within the left, the right, and the center, making friend-enemy distinctions in an increasingly desperate bid to make sense of a world that is utterly beyond them. And while the elites are getting worse, the workers aren't organizing themselves. There are people who are trying to organize the workers, but it seems unlikely they can overcome the collapse of associationism. At any rate, they don't seem to be moving fast enough to deal with the speed and pace of all this. What if we can't raise the consciousness of lots of people quickly enough? What if we have to work with the people we have? I supported Bernie Sanders in the 10s, in large part because I thought his kind of socialism recognized that the workers needed help to get back into a position where they could organize effectively. They needed more favorable conditions, conditions they themselves were not in position to generate through their own action. By granting robust economic rights, I thought the state could generate conditions that made better forms of organization possible. But today, even that vision exceeds the horizons of most people. Healthcare, housing, and education are completely off the agenda, and conditions in all of these sectors are worsening, making it even harder for people to put together the physical, mental, and spiritual energy necessary to organize. What if the consolidation of the modern state has marketized society to the point where associationism no longer works in the way it once did? Is there anything we can do with smaller numbers of people? Or is it a mistake even to think about this? Do we have to insist against the evidence of our eyes and ears that capitalism always produces the kind of society that can be organized to overcome it? that appeals to the state are necessarily reactionary? I think many people on the left have been wrestling with these questions in recent years. It's produced, on the one hand, a kind of traditional Marxism that flirts with anarchism, and on the other hand, a state socialism that expresses a nostalgia for the 20th century nation-state in its various forms, Fordist, Stalinist, Maoist. But while one of these sides identifies with early 20th century society, and the other identifies with the mid-20th century state, both identify with historical moments that have passed. In that sense, both are forms of reaction. Is there a way of doing left politics that tarries with our moment instead of pining for lost opportunities in the past? If Marxism is scientific socialism, if it is about carefully observing our historical moment, endeavoring to make sense of history so that we can find and exploit opportunities to advance the goal of human emancipation, these forms of quixotic socialism aren't Marxist. Even if traditional Marxism is faithful to the words on the page, even if it does capture Marx's intentions as he understood them, it is not Marxism in this deeper and more fundamental sense. At its best, modern political theory delivers insights because it focuses on the needs of the present moment, breaking free of assumptions that the present must conform to the past. But the contemporary left isn't modern in this sense. It isn't at all interested in the present. It's completely obsessed with history. It isn't interested in observing what's really going on. I keep thinking of all those scenes in Yojimbo where our Ronin peers out of some peephole, catching a glimpse of what's going on. He understands intuitively that before you can rush into thinking and acting, you have to actually look at the situation. You can't run from it. Maybe Kurosawa was a reactionary running from modern Japan, but there's something about his Ronin that cannot be reduced to that. Anyway, I've gone on long enough. Let's see what Nina thinks.
Oh my gosh. Wow, that was very impressive. I think I'm just going to have to go with your reading because, frankly, my take on the film was far more superficial insofar as it was primarily concerned with gesture and aesthetics. I got completely obsessed with the look of the film. I sort of failed to understand much of the logic of the gang warfare or really what was at stake, because I was so entranced, I suppose, by the not only the kind of tribute to the American Western, but also the kind of Japanese translation of that into these extraordinary mannerisms and swagger and just beautiful ways in which the Ronin was holding his arms, for example, and this kind of posture of nobility and rest. And I suppose also this, yeah, like how to put it? Well, just extraordinary physiognomy of the gangs. You know, these men had absolutely bizarre haircuts. Their sort of heads were visible, like they I don't know how to describe this type of hairstyle. It's kind of almost monk-like, but it's very, very odd, and very, very beautiful outfits and these kind of what are they called, like palanquins or something, these little things that you carry people around in, and all of, I suppose, this fetishization, as you say, for the past, you know, if it's set in the mid-19th century. The invasion of the gun is not only a tribute, obviously, to the American Western, but also to technology itself. And that, as you say, the dying of a way of life, right? And its habits and its nobility in the case of the samurai or the Ronin. And, you know, all of these kind of rituals. And we know that Japan is perhaps in some ways more visibly protective of some of its rituals than other countries are. And Japan, as far as I understand it, I've never been. I would absolutely love to go, but is in the, I guess, the popular imagination, the way that we understand it, is quite singular and quite distinct, and is clearly very keen to protect its borders. Apart from anything else, we associate, I guess, with a certain kind of stagflation, a certain kind of economy. I know that there are various shifts in Japanese culture now towards perhaps rearming the army and things like this. I'm not sure exactly. Perhaps problems potentially with China. Anyway, so the film, as you understood it, as this kind of, I don't know, almost treatise on political theory, with the Ronin being a kind of Socrates with a sword, which I thought was very, very well done. I one thing that comes to mind, I suppose, in thinking about reaction is, in the first place, to talk about whether being a reactionary is always a bad thing. My increasing feeling is that it is not. Of course, being accused of being reactionary is a common, slur or fear that people have. I mean, what do we associate with reactionaries? People who don't understand, as you say, the present moment, who perhaps are nostalgic, who fetishize the past, who, you know, perhaps unreasonably desire a way of life which in some ways maybe never existed. And much of leftist or modernist theory is often an attempt to disavow the idea that there was ever any kind of golden age, whether it's Freud talking about the father, you know, there never was this great father that was then destroyed, for example, or the idea that there was ever some sort of harmonious society in which everybody was well behaved and everything functioned properly. Of course there was not. Nevertheless, I do think it's interesting that, for example, we have various movements like the reactionary feminist movement, which I am definitely adjacent to, if not part of, and a kind of criticism of progress as it's generally rolled in on the left, the idea that feminism is part of just a progressive narrative. And I think many people are taking a step back from the idea of progress or progressiveness, and maybe even in a humorous way, as Mary Harrington originally proposed it, it was kind of a joke. You know, the reactionary feminist phrase was something that was leveled at her by a friend, and she adopted it as a sort of humorous adage. And I think there's something amusing about it. But so I suppose, you know, that the Kurosawa film is, from my point of view, very, very beautiful, very interesting insofar as it translates this genre. The gestures and the men are just extraordinary looking. I got the point about kind of morality and altruism, and the fact that the samurai, if you like, is upholding older values or different values, and the fact that this town had sort of degenerated into gambling and gang warfare. And the point I took from the gambling aspect was that if you reduce everything to numbers, you know, you end up basically in this completely cynical world of exchange and duplicity, and, you know, where everyone is sort of striving after money, but not only money, a kind of, they do talk about luck, you know, some people are unlucky and so on. And so, but it's a vision of the world which is perhaps tempting, but extremely reductive. So the fact that he can afford, if you like, to be indifferent to money points to this higher realm or a set of higher values, and his nobility just in his personhood, you know, the way he carries himself. Of course, he's like the Lone Ranger, or he's like the Western hero, or they're often anti-heroes as well, but he's like the kind of the lonesome cowboy, you know, and there is something about the Western which is this kind of man against the universe, like this man standing solid but alone, right? That the cowboy is often detached from all of these bonds, social bonds. His family is either disappeared or been killed, or, you know, that there is this sort of absolute sort of singularity almost of the cowboy. And so in that sense, there is this, this sort of great beauty. But I'm very impressed with your reading. I think as we've discussed before, I often fall into the trap of being just blatantly anti-institutional. Like, I have this tendency to engage in a form of Illichian institutional critique, which is not particularly productive, because it stresses what I see as the corruption, and what, for example, what many people see as the corruption in many of our contemporary institutions, whether it be the BBC or the NHS or the media. And, you know, and it's very easy to do this, right? Like, you know, we've just had a whole series of kind of very, I suppose, events that inspire a kind of mistrust in our ruling class. We could say everything from COVID to various political positions. You know, literally nobody in Britain has any faith in the ruling class, in the government, in politicians. But it is much more interesting and much harder to ask the kind of questions that you're asking, about the relationship of Labour and the state, for example, and the question of organisation. So perhaps maybe if we could turn to that question of how you understand reaction.
Yeah, and I think you're right to point to how visually stunning the film is. There's a lot of really interesting visual detail. Kurosawa is really great at visuals, and I'm not great at talking about or describing visuals, so it doesn't play as large a role in my account, but I can recognize that he put a lot of thought into these scenes, far more than I can put into anything visual. On the question of reactionary, I see the reactionary is very closely related to the quixotic. So a kind of desire for a form of society or for a form of politics that is no longer possible. Maybe it never existed, but even if it did exist, it can't exist now. And if you try to bring it back, you might accomplish something, because there's often an imputation that reactionaries are threatening, or that they pose a problem. If they were just committed to something that was impossible, then they would just be crazy. They would be kind of insane people. They wouldn't pose a problem. But I think there is also this idea that the reactionary won't succeed in resurrecting the form of life, but in their efforts to resurrect the form of life will create some kind of mutated or deformed, really bad thing that isn't what they were looking to create, and also differs from what exists. I think the kind of Francis Fukuyama argument about the end of history involves a kind of implicit accusation that both the left and the right are necessarily reactionary insofar as they don't accept the end of history as a fact. And so from his standpoint, both the left and the right have become forms of reaction because they're nostalgic for 20th century ideological struggle. So this is something that I think is the kernel of what's really intriguing about Fukuyama for the left, is this idea that maybe they themselves have become reactionary, that there's no longer a way of having a left that is in harmony with the present moment.
Yes, and I think, I guess we see that position in organizations like Platypus, and, you know, I've spoken with, I'm quite good friends with someone who is a Platypus-minded person, extraordinarily intelligent, a fantastic reader of Hegel and Marx, and works on aesthetics. And yes, I mean, I think it's a very significant starting point, I think, to the idea that the left is dead insofar as it, in its classical sense, right, in the sense that we understood it historically, and again, that poses a much harder set of questions then. So yeah, I think this idea that both the left and the right are reactionary is probably better place to begin, as opposed to simply saying, well, all reaction is right wing, right? Because it clearly isn't. But I guess that's a sort of left liberal idea, and that any kind of populist movement that draws upon ideas of the past or so supposedly outmoded abstractions like the nation or the people or whatever must be dangerous in the way that you're saying. And I think, you know, it's very interesting in the context of just yesterday, it'll be later by the time this goes out, but we had the shutting down of the National Conservatism Conference in Brussels, which was extremely counterproductive, it seems to me, at the level of optics, because, you know, I mean, I spoke at one of these events. It's organized by a kind of Jewish conservative guy called Yoram Hazony. He's set it up. It's sort of made up of various people, some who are associated with conservative parties, some who are religious, some who are free market ideologues, you know, some libertarians. I mean, I would say, actually, it's enormously contradictory and enormously antagonistic. And the one in London was filled with people who were extremely critical of, let's say, really existing conservatism, particularly in Britain, where we've had 14 years of a supposedly conservative government. And, you know, it was in no way any kind of sort of propaganda rally for the Tory party. And they had many of the same speakers, or some of the same speakers, in Brussels. And yesterday, this event was closed down, this conference, and it was in its third location, hosted, I think, by a Tunisian free speech advocate was the final person who agreed to host it. They got police there. They wouldn't let Eric Zemmour in, and you know, they're blocking people from coming out. It was really quite a big scandal, I suppose you'd say. And the excuse given was that they couldn't ensure the safety because the conference was under threat by potential left-wing protesters. So they were sort of invoking safety as the reason why this conservative conference couldn't go ahead. And I think this is very revealing of a certain technocratic mindset, which is sort of very afraid. And the Brussels mayor, in his letter, outlined that he was opposed to people who were arguing against abortion, I think he said, and that people who were critical of the European Union, as if these were positions that were just completely beyond the pale and completely unacceptable, and nobody should have any reason for holding these positions whatsoever. And obviously, shutting down a conference, whether it's pro-Palestinian, we've seen this too, we've seen various pro-Palestinian people being cancelled or suspended from their jobs, conferences being shut down. I think in Germany, there was one recently. You know, what we're seeing, I think, is a kind of really authoritarian crackdown on dialogue or disagreement from the standpoint of a liberal position that pretends it is neutral, but of course is anything but. But I think this narrowing of the range of opinion is partly justified by the liberal order in its invocation of reaction, you know, the fear of a kind of populist reaction from the right. And, you know, without them understanding that their own politics of authoritarian, you know, liberalism is also reactionary. You know, I agree with this kind of 360 degree diagnosis of reaction. I suppose one of the really difficult questions I have is the relationship that we have as the kind of creature that we are, like by virtue of being human, in the context of modernity, which is to say the historical moment we find ourselves in. Perhaps we are at the end of history, perhaps we are, you know, at the end of history, perhaps we are in post-modernity, perhaps, you know, but there's definitely a sense in which we are in a certain relation to the technology we use, the connectivity we experience. We have a concept of the global, which has superseded that of the international, we could say, which is not great for leftist politics. And we are dealing with concepts like populations and things like that. You know, Foucault talks about this in relation to biopolitics and the forms of governance that follow from these kind of quasi-biological political categories. And I don't know how to relate the fact that we are still very old kinds of creatures who suffer all of the same things as our ancestors did, perhaps with different names. But what is it about modernity that we would want to preserve in the name of making life better for as many people as possible. And I'm not a utilitarian in any way, right? I don't think there are ways we can quantify outcomes in that sense, nor should we see the world in this quantified way. But if we are to remain leftist, not non-reactionary leftists, or I think Eleanor Langer calls it, how does she put it? Anti-leftist Marxists, you know, so opposed to what gets called the left or much of the left today, but true, as you say, to not Marx's intention, not Marx's historical period, but rather the implications of a Marxist analysis of capital. How do we reconcile, or how do we understand what is happening to humanity en masse in this context?
Yeah, a couple of things I thought about listening to that. One is, I think part of the trouble is that we're operating often at this level of the supranational, which is not global, but also not national. So we have these institutions, and they're often framed as regional, but they're not just regional. They are, nor are they just international, because they're not just the products of states coming together and making agreements. They sit somewhere between the nation state level and truly global institutions. They're not truly global. And I think part of what makes the supranational institutions so ineffective is this in-betweenness. They don't have the ability to govern capital around the world from the point of view of human values. They work on market incentives that are impersonal and inhuman. So they're not a proper form of governance as such. And yet they very much truncate and mutilate the capacities of states to make interventions. And that supranational level also becomes a constant, you know, even insofar as states do have capacities, they can always blame their lack of the use of the capacities they do retain on the supranational level and the demands of satisfying it. So it has taken on this mediating role that I don't think we really had until the post-war era. And I don't think we fully understand even now, because of this tendency either to say, really, it's all about states, or it's global, or it's civilizational. There are all these different ways of framing it that don't grasp that supranational quality. And I think that's why I like using that term. I think it gets at something that's missed.
But it just, at the risk of being too empiricist, I mean, would you describe something like the EU or even social media platforms in this way? Are these the kind of supranational things you're talking about?
Yeah, TNCs, organizations like the EU, also the World Bank, the IMF, WTO.
Yeah. Okay. NATO, WEF.
Yeah, NATO. They're all things that are bigger than the nation state, that theoretically constrain the nation state, but aren't properly global.
Yes.
And understood. When we think about them as if they're properly global, it implies a level of centrality or control or organization to them that's personal, that they don't have. So I think a lot of people who think in terms of the global with respect to this stuff often assume that it has an agency to it, or that it's serving a small, narrow group of very rich people in an overt and direct way.
Yes, I mean, I don't think they're necessarily wrong in the latter case, but I think, you know, it's interesting. I saw some kind of random leftist post on Facebook, and they were getting anxious about the increasing use of the term multipolarity. So I suppose one of the ideas is that we've moved from, you know, the Cold War situation, a kind of bipolarity, to multipolarity, which is a phrase that a lot of people are using lately, to try to describe, I guess, something that is coming out of what comes after, I suppose, a liberal order, you know, with America at the center, which maybe involves like China and Saudi Arabia and Russia and America and Europe as bit players, right?
But yeah, they're trying to think back to the states.
Right.
Right. So they're trying to think in terms of a multi-state system with multiple locuses of power in a multiple states. But that's a very 20th century scheme for it, because all of those states are, what's different about now is they're all in these organizations that supranational.
America is interesting insofar as it doesn't actually sign up to some of these organizations, but...
Well, it has the capacity to break them itself, yes. Right? The United States could destroy the WTO and the IMF and the World Bank if it wanted to, but it also economically benefits enormously from its creation of and participation in those organizations,
mm-hmm.
In that all of that organizes the consumption faucet that legitimates the government in the United States. If you right. disrupt that consumption faucet like they did just a teeny, teeny bit of during COVID, all hell mm-hmm. breaks loose politically.
But it's obvious that if you were China, you might be seeking to make alliances with, as they are, with many other countries, right? To shore up your own power block.
Well, I think out of concern that if you were to be ejected from the system,
mm-hmm.
all of a sudden you'd have all this production capacity and you'd have trouble selling it to somebody. So you have to create the infrastructure to sell what you're producing to alternative markets. So there's this attempt by China to cultivate alternative markets in the event that it gets locked out of the Western bloc.
Well, that seems reasonable, no?
Yes, but I think it's a defensive maneuver rather than a sign of China's growing strength. Mm-hmm. It's a concern on China's part that the United States is becoming belligerent toward it.
But what would it take for the American empire to crumble? I mean, all empires end, right?
Well, I think that it would require the internal issues that the United States has to be exacerbated in some way. And I think the weakness of the United States is not competition from outside. If anything, competition from outside has tended historically to strengthen it by causing it to be more sensible in its behavior. It's the divisions internally within the American state that are kicked up by the degree to which the American Constitution was written to prevent tyranny, to prevent concentrations of power. And that's where I was drawn to this film, because this film has, you know, these gangs that are just mindlessly at odds with one another. And it's similar to the American parties. They act like they want to fight, but they don't really. They actually are very scared of any kind of serious fight. You know, the different parts of the American state frame it like they're in this death struggle with one another, but they're not really. And they're actually very scared of a real confrontation. And whenever one comes up, they will, you know, try to brandish their swords at one another menacingly so that they can be seen to be tough, but they don't actually want to fight because they know that a civil conflict in the United States would be an absolute catastrophe for everybody involved.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's kind of good that they don't actually want to fight, right? I mean, saber rattling is like an important part of diplomacy, one might say.
Right. But one of the things that this film kicked up is this idea that, you know, if you really wanted to get out of the moment that we're in historically and the period that we're in historically, well, what you would do is you would not go, oh, thank God they're not fighting each other. You would go, well, at some point, the only way for all of this to change is for something to go horribly wrong within the United States political system and for that political system to implode in some way. And you'd think like the Ronin thinks that you ought to in some way accelerate that implosion by trying to tip. And that's something that already seems to want to happen. There's already some degree of this wanting to happen in the States. And so you wouldn't be working against history by trying to just tip it into happening already. You would be accelerating what's already going on.
Yes. I mean, I think, you know, Alex Garland's recent film, The Civil War, I don't know if you've seen it yet.
Not yet, no.
I mean, it's kind of unsuccessful, I think, in many ways, but it does attempt to try to show you what a post-Civil War situation in the States might look like, right? But he does it sort of deliberately without politics, without specific reference to any political concerns, right? There's just been a civil war, right? And then there are factions, they have names, but you don't really understand, and perhaps neither do they, what they are what they stand for. Even though there is a kind of campaign to sort of topple the nominal head, the president, in the film.
Yeah, I read that they put California and Texas in an alliance with each other, which doesn't make any sense at all. But right. Maybe they did that just to make it so that nobody could project any kind of contemporary allegory onto it.
Yeah, I think so. I think he didn't want it to be, and he's not American, let's be clear. But he didn't want the film to be read as like either some liberal critique of Trump or a kind of MAGA or a sort of secret, you know, MAGA chud film, you know. So it's kind of trying to avoid that, although the president is very much, I would say, a Trump like figure. He looks a bit like Steve Bannon. There is a kind of Trump-ishness.
Isn't he Nick Offerman from Parks and Recreation?
Yeah. You know, the Nick Offerman character in Parks and Recreation is really funny because they originally wanted him to be a villain. But he actually turns out to be really one of the most lovable characters in the whole show, right? They wanted this guy to be this kind of awful, reactionary right winger who was just taking the state money because he wanted to show how corrupt the state was. But actually, everyone ended up rooting for him. So they had to try and change his character somewhat, which I think is funny.
He fit very much into the kind of Ron Paul moment that show came out during.
Mm.
He was a very Ron Paul libertarian, the Nick Offerman character.
Yeah, absolutely. But libertarians are a strange unknown quantity, but I guess you have more of them in America. We don't really have libertarians. Well, very few, I would say. Like, certainly not in the political system, really, in Britain. You have kind of free marketeers, but you have, like, I don't know how many Ayn Randians we have.
Well, in the UK, there's a need to visibly interface more with reality. I think a lot of American libertarians get embroiled in arguments about what freedom means or what liberty means, and then they start trying to deduce all of society from the conclusions they've drawn about those philosophical questions. So it's a very philosophy heavy species of market liberalism, where, as in the UK, I think most political traditions are more pragmatic in their orientation.
I think Britain has this reputation for pragmatism, which is deserved. I think it's correct. You know, I used to, you know, be really against this empiricist tendency of the Anglosphere.
Sometimes it goes too far because sometimes it becomes a something that limits your imagination. Or I think it has often in the past historically compelled Britain to assume that certain things about the past must go on forever. Like, you know, Britain has to stay on the gold standard and has to pay off that Napoleonic war debt, no matter what this does to Britain's capacity to make state investments or how much this allows Germany and the United States to catch up. I think this mentality was very much part of the gradual decline in the 19th century of the empire.
Benjamin, a man's word is his bond.
See, there's something about that that isn't just pragmatic. If it was really just pragmatic, there's also a little bit of a kind of hobbity attitude that is part of the story here.
How dare you? No, I mean, I basically grew up in Hobbiton. So, yeah, I mean, absolutely. But look, I mean,
I don't mean that in a disparaging way. I think, you know, everybody likes the Hobbits. They're kind of lovely bourgeois fellows.
No, they're like little pagan pan gods, you know? They're like, you know, and they have rituals and habits and values.
But they have too much unsocial sociability. There are too many moments where Bilbo goes, oh, I hate those Sackville Bagginses. Oh, I hate my party. I don't want all these people coming to my house. Why are these dwarves in my house? Why are they
really
mucking up the place?
He doesn't really mean it. It's sort of, you know, humorous way of dealing
with
pluralism.
Well, that's the thing, unsocial sociability, right? He doesn't really mean it, and yet he also does get bothered and annoyed by all of this community-oriented stuff. There is a... Yeah, he'll become part of the company. You know, it's a company, right, in The Hobbit. It's Thorin and Company, and they have a contract.
Yeah.
It's very bourgeois.
Well, I don't know. I mean, we sort of invented like some of this early stuff, like contract law and trusts and charity and equity and, you know, and hedgerows and stuff.
Right. And so I think one of the things that's distinctive about the British bourgeoisie is that it has this kind of rural pastoral character because of how early it forms.
Yeah. I think that's fair enough. And some of these were really quite extraordinary solutions to problems. I mean, like the Crusades issue with the trusts, you know, inventing trusts for the families of the fighters who are going on the Crusades. It is quite innovative. I don't know. The law is very seductive when you read about it. It becomes very impressive, but you know, it's also an ass as well. And obviously if people just could deal with things without the law, that would be good, but we can't, apparently. So you invent a third thing and then the third thing becomes the first thing and then everything becomes the law.
And the law also used to have a lot more flex in it.
Well, I mean, English and Welsh law and Scottish law does have creative flexibility in many ways, except for the fact that we've sort of made millions of laws, which is
it still has a fair amount of flex in it. Yeah. But I'm thinking in terms of, you know, early medieval law before there was this attempt to get everything real exact. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes scholars in the past have looked at how the same law might be applied in different parts of Christendom, right? So the same, you know, ecclesiastical law will often be applied very differently in the early Middle Ages, depending on where you are. And some historians used to read this as a sign that that the law was weak in these places, or that mm-hmm. The bishops and priests in these places were disobedient. The ecclesiastical courts were disobedient to the center. But that isn't how people at the time seem to have received them. So it seems instead that there was just a much greater level of flexibility with regard to interpretation. And a lot of our historiography on Roman law in the Roman period seems to back this up, that mm-hmm. there's kind of an understanding that a governor in a province might not enforce the law or might not interpret the law in precisely the same way based on knowledge of local conditions, and that that wouldn't make him disloyal or disobedient in and of itself.
Right. And you know, I mean, if you read E.P. Thompson, the great book Customs in Common, and Peter Linnabaugh and these kind of historians of the early law and Magna Carta and the sort of transition from customs, feudal customs to law, it's very, very, very interesting because of just how closely tied these original customs were to specific places. And of course they were. You know, so precisely all of these things like estivers and like whether widows could go and collect twigs and when the farmers could get their pigs to eat the acorns and who got to access what when, like it's all completely tied to the land, right? And these specific things.
And even the formalization of a lot of stuff as sacraments, like marriage wasn't formalized as a sacrament until the High Middle Ages. Mm. And so there was a lot more scope for divorce or for permissible separation coming out of the Roman period. Because, of course, in the Roman political system, divorce was often necessary for political reasons. And it wasn't until the High Middle Ages that there was really a proper attempt to close up the possibility of divorce. And that makes a lot of that, you know, like Thomas Aquinas. We think of him as a medieval thinker, but he comes along at the end of the Middle Ages. Mm-hmm. And all that Thomas scholasticism is very late and not really how things were done for most of the medieval period. You know, it's all very specific and precise and worked out, and what's natural is schematized in a way that it wasn't earlier on. And I think sometimes a overly strict adherence to Aquinas and the those very, very precise readings, which are very compelling because they're so specific and clear, leads people to understand the natural in an overly rigid way, in a more rigid way than it was originally understood.
I just like the hierarchy of angels stuff. That's just great. where you had this just categorization of all these different types of angels, and it's so beautiful.
Right, all the metaphysics is just, here it is, it's all laid out.
But it's kind of wonderful. It's like, I don't know, it's very magical. But sure.
Yeah, it's the detail and precision of it that's so compelling, right? And then the fact that there's all this argument for the detail.
Mm,
that every one of these details is backed up in some way by an argument.
Mm-hmm. No, sure. And then I guess you have a sort of, I don't know, sort of pantheistic, sort of Spinozist backlash. I don't know if it's really, can be really understood in that way, but a kind of,
yeah, I think
know.
You could understand all of Protestantism in a way as a backlash to the church becoming overly schematic. The church trying, and the reason the church had to do that is because there were so many internal disputes in the church in the 11th and 12th and 13th centuries about dogma. And the papacy, it's interesting, I've been working on this thing about Nicola Rem. The papacy for a long time just kept saying to these priests who would petition it for decisions, you guys should just be obedient to the people who run your specific monasteries or your specific regional institutions. You shouldn't be pestering the Pope about, what kinds of outfits you should be wearing. You should just ask your immediate superiors those questions. You shouldn't be constantly trying to go around to the Pope. And but they wouldn't take that for an answer. They kept insisting that the Pope make decisions, and they kept not listening to their immediate superiors and going all the way up the chain to the Pope. And this eventually compels the Pope to make these judgments, just to put these issues to bed. And then as soon as the Pope does that, he's accused of being a tyrant. And so the Pope is kind of dragged by the internal disputes within the church into a position that then weakens the church enormously going forward. I think it's fascinating. I think this is often how centralization happens. The layers that are further down fight with each other so much, and then appeals are made to the king or to the Pope. And even if the king or Pope knows that it's not a good idea to get involved in all these downstream disputes, if there are enough of them and they go on long enough, eventually he gets dragged into it.
Yeah, it's very interesting, isn't it? It's like, what kind of authority? I mean, but it's like, how do you divide up where authority lies? I mean, I mentioned before I was reading the Moses section in the Bible, and this question of law comes in really early, unsurprisingly, and who has the authority to make decisions and judgments, and after the Ten Commandments, there's still going to be problems of like neighborly disagreement and, you know, what the right thing to do is in this situation. And
I think it was already inherently confused in Western Europe by the fact that the Western Roman Empire had collapsed. So there was this gaping hole in all of the theories of how things ought to work, and this uncertainty about whether that could be filled, and if so, by what.
Yeah, but it's very interesting to think of Protestantism in this sense as a form of derogation of it to individual interpretation, right? Say, look, like, work it out for yourself, guys.
Right. First, it's create a bunch of intermediary institutions. Then when that doesn't work, it's the Pope will decide because he's in at the center and in charge. And then when that doesn't work, it reverts to the individual and the whole thing. Yeah.
But it creates the individual. That's the thing, right? So it precisely the literate, the reader, like in a culture, moving from a culture in which very few people read and very few people have books and very few people certainly understand Latin, to then having the King James Bible, which is, of course, the one we read, and this enormously influential text to an explosion of publishing and literacy, the family Bible, people... I don't know, like it's so interesting how those technologies create the individual, right?
Yeah, that's right. I shouldn't have used the term revert. That was a mistake. That was lazy of me.
No,
I think you're right. It was just a sloppy word choice. But I do think that there's kind of a parallel with what's been going on lately, right? Because you have this, the market system becomes dysfunctional, and this compels the state, even though the liberal state doesn't want to get involved in the 20th century, it does get involved. And then once it gets involved, the kind of centrality of its uniform culture that it imposes in the middle of the 20th century inspires an individualist response, right? And so you go from a world where you have a bunch of civil associations in the 19th century to a world where it's centralized around the total state in the middle of the 20th century to a world where it's over-individualized to the point where nobody knows what's going on. We've kind of replicated this within modernity. The same problems that we had in medieval Catholicism have been replicated in modernity.
Yeah, but what comes after the individual?
Well, a change in the form of the of politics itself, right? What ultimately happens is that you get the 18th century and the doing away with that whole type of state, right? The whole Catholic type of state in favor of this modern liberal state. So if modern liberalism is now producing the same kind of confusion, eventually that confusion will have to produce a situation where a different kind of state can come about, right? And like when we did the devils way back when, there's this gradual, you know, erosion of the mediating stuff. You know,
I love that film.
The different parts of the state set upon each other and try in some way to get rid of each other, that the elites fight each other in such a way that it eventually produces a clarifying situation.
Yeah.
Right, which is l'état, c'est moi.
Yeah, exactly. And they use cancel culture and people's personal idiosyncrasies against some political ends, you know, for not the ends that are purported to be, but actually other political ends, you know. And it's so well done, I think. I think it's always like this, except, I don't know, this situation where you have this increasing detachment, like, I often wonder how paranoid one should be. Like, I don't think it's good to be paranoid, obviously. I don't think paranoia is a good state to be in most of the time. I think it is an occasionally interesting perspective that one can adopt, if one can do it without too much damage to oneself, if you see what I mean. Like, it's a way of looking at the world. And it is very interesting to think about the reason why there has been a mass manufacture of the PMC, of this class of people who are, on one level, heavily indebted, right? So you've just created a time... You've delayed your own disintegration by getting millions of people into debt. You also don't have to provide work for them immediately, right? So it's a kind of delaying tactic. But they thought that
the pace of change would be faster. In the 60s and 70s and 80s, they thought that we were going to technologically develop really quickly and rapidly reach a point where you were post-work. So they thought in that kind of situation, manual skills had become increasingly completely irrelevant and that it would all be about university degrees. And that would be the only thing that would give you any basis for employment. And then very quickly, even that would become unnecessary. And then going to university would just be about bettering yourself as a human being and having a college experience that ought to be part of everybody's life. I think that's what was motivating them. They had this kind of Andre Gore's Jetsons, the future is coming lightning fast. They thought that there was exponential growth in the rate of progress, not even just linear, but exponential. And so therefore we would be today, you know, in a completely technologically revolutionized condition where entirely different forms of social life would be possible. Instead, we're in this kind of mixed, weird position, post-industrial, but not fully digital in the sense that people thought we would be digital.
Sure. And even if you had created a leisure class or like a post-work society, it's not clear like what people would sort of then do with themselves that wouldn't be destructive. You know, and we do have these kind of problems too, really.
Well, that comes back to, you know, then you have to ask all these questions about creating virtuous people that are ancient and medieval questions that
you have
to bring back and re-engage from the point of view of abundance. Speaking of automation, by the way, I do want to mention for our listeners, and maybe you, if you haven't heard about it, Alex Hochuli wrote this great piece for Damage Magazine, where he does a critique of UBI, and then he does a critique of 15-minute cities, and then he does a critique of post-liberalism. So he kind of picks on each of the different things as an insufficient response to the moment. This idea that everybody's reactionary because nobody's able to actually respond to the moment, I think is kind of grasped by Alex in that piece.
Amazing.
And he His it's the best left critique of 15 Minute Cities I've read so far. It's a really great
I have the physical issue of Damage issue 1. If it's in issue 1, which it probably is, which I keep meaning to read.
Yeah, I can't remember if it's in issue 1 or 2, but it's in Damage. Okay. At Alex Ochulli from BangaCast. It's yes. A really cool piece.
Cool, I will read it.
Anyway, we should wrap up. So thank you guys so much for listening. We're going to go to the B-side now. Have a wonderful rest of the day. Bye-bye.
Bye.